Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 28th of December, these are our main stories. China has told its nationals in parts of northern Myanmar to evacuate because of escalating risks of conflict. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has urged Israel to end the unlawful killings of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Rights groups say the Indian government is continuing to target journalists by putting spyware on their phones. Also in this podcast, scientists say they found an easy way to identify water and signs of life on planets in other solar systems. And Ghana is entranced by a musical world record attempt. The longest ever sing-a-thon started on Christmas Eve. In recent months, rebel groups in northern Myanmar have seized several towns and military outposts along the border with China, posing a huge challenge for the military junta. Now, China has urged its nationals in the region to evacuate because of the escalating conflict. A spokeswoman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Mao Ning, warned Chinese citizens of the increased safety risks in the Laokai district.
The current security situation in Myanmar's Kokang Autonomous Region is grim and complicated. We remind Chinese citizens not to travel to northern Myanmar for now and call on Chinese citizens already there to move to a safe area.
I spoke to our South Asia correspondent Jonathan Head and asked why China is telling people to leave.
That's interesting because it's not the first time it's done it. I mean, this fighting's been going on for 2 months. But I sense a greater urgency now because the one of the three ethnic groups, the MNDAA, which is fighting there, really is at the point it's about to capture Laokai. This was its target. It's the main town there. It's the center of this notorious scam business in the region, which China wanted shut down. And we assume is the reason why China tacitly accepted these rebel groups making all these advances. After 2 months, it looks like the MNDAA is on the point of taking Laokai. There's a lot of bad blood between them and a rival group, a pro-military group that's been running the town for the past 20 years. And so it's quite likely it could get a bit messy when they take over. I think China's view also is that anybody left in Laokai is either involved in the scams or a victim of the scams. Remember, most of the people involved in running these scams are, in fact, ethnic Chinese. And so, in a sense, you know, what's interesting is that China has been bigging up the peace talks it's been trying to get going between these groups and the military for the last 2 or 3 weeks. But clearly they accept that they cannot control the situation in this part of northeastern Myanmar, and the fighting is going to go on, putting anybody left at risk.
Yeah, as you say, China has been mediating between the rebel groups and the military. Is this really a sign that those talks have failed?
Well, I think China probably always understood they were going to be difficult. And the reality is, these groups have got two goals. These are groups with specific ethnic community ambitions to run their own areas. There also is an element of warlordism involved as well. They have taken a lot of territory. They want to hold it. The Myanmar military has been badly beaten in this area, but will want to hold on to whatever it can. That's why the talks are difficult. Now, officially, these groups are also saying they are now part of the broader opposition with an ultimate goal of overthrowing the military government. They keep saying that. They keep saying the fighting will go on because of that. It's not quite clear how much securing their own interests and securing their own territory will trump the larger goal of supporting the broader opposition, which they still say they stick to. If they are serious about that, well, obviously these talks can't succeed because the civil war goes on and these rebel groups will continue to fight because they say they're supporting this overall goal of overthrowing the military junta.
Southeast Asia correspondent for the BBC, Jonathan Head. It is a piece of news that will be welcomed in Ukraine. The last tranche of US military aid for Kyiv without fresh authorization from Congress. $250 million worth of air defense, artillery and small arms ammunition has been made available. But the talks in Washington about any further support remain stalled. Our correspondent Shingai Nyoka sent this report.
The $250 million military aid package includes air defence equipment, 15 million rounds of ammunition, as well as ammunition for rocket systems and artillery. And with this disbursement, the US has exhausted the funding it had set aside to help Ukraine fight the Russian invasion. In its statement announcing this final package, the White House urged Congress to urgently pass a new funding request so as to keep Ukraine's war efforts on track and to defend territory it recaptured from Russia. In a statement, Secretary of State Blinken said it was imperative that Congress act swiftly as soon as possible to advance the U.S.'s national security interests by helping Ukraine defend itself. President Biden has asked Congress for another $61 billion for Ukraine, but some Republicans are refusing to approve the assistance without an agreement to tighten security along the U.S.-Mexico border. A coalition of more than 50 countries continues to provide critical support for Ukraine's forces, but global backing for the war has begun to wane as the fighting drags on.
Shingai Nyoka in Washington. In Russia, reciting poetry can lead to long prison sentences, at least for two men who were jailed for what the prosecutors called inciting hatred and threatening state security. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, told me about what reading poetry in Russia can lead to.
It sounds shocking in many parts of the world, but this is what happened to Artyom Kumadin, who's now 33. He got sentenced to 7 years by a court in Moscow, and Yegor Shtovba, he's 23, and he got 5.5 years in jail. Really long sentences. Basically, both of them were participating at a rally at a square in Moscow that had been used in Soviet times by dissidents to recite poetry and things like that. They were anti-war activists, and Artyom Kumadin recited a poem called Kill Me, Militia Man. Now, this was a very sensitive time. September last year, Russia and the Kremlin had announced a partial mobilisation of troops, so the Kremlin was particularly keen to crack down on dissent at that time. And soon after the incident, he was arrested. Kumadin was arrested. He said he was raped with an object in there, and his fiance, who was there at the time of the raid, told our Russian editor Steve Rosenberg what happened.
They dragged me across the floor by my hair. They started super gluing stickers to my face. Then I heard the beating from the room where Artyom was. They grabbed me by the hair and showed me a photo of him, naked and beaten up, covered in blood.
There were reports after this particular court case that relatives of the two men cried shame at the verdict, and Mr. Kumadin's father called it a total outrage.
Why the harsh reaction?
Well, basically, the Kremlin has been trying ever since the start of its full-scale invasion of Ukraine to control the public sphere. It controls the narrative through the state media, but that in itself is not enough. So it passed legislation that criminalises things like calling it a war. It's officially known as a special military operation, and spreading false information, it says, or damaging national security and discrediting Russian armed forces. So it's very harsh legislation. The UN has criticised it, calling it a new low in freedom of expression, saying it's trying to shrink independent media and also the space for civic society.
Danny Eberhardt. Journalists in India may be monitored much more closely by the government than is legally allowed, according to the human rights group Amnesty International. It says officials have secretly installed invasive Pegasus spyware on some journalists' phones, which allows every communication they make to be monitored. I asked our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan, in Delhi to tell us more about the spyware and how the government uses it.
An Israeli firm makes this Pegasus spyware, and this company categorically states that it is sold only to law enforcement agencies around the world, especially to monitor terrorism, to tackle money laundering and other major crimes. Now, how it works is that it basically takes control of your phone, even though the Android phones could be easily exploited. It was a bit difficult on iPhone, but now with the Pegasus, for the last few years, several journalists have been complaining about how their phones were acting bizarrely when later on an analysis found out that there were traces of this Pegasus software. So basically, it takes control of your messages and your photographs, your contacts, and it can also trigger the video camera and monitor all kinds of communication. Imagine if you are a journalist, investigative journalist, working on a story against the government, and you are trying to talk to one of the government sources or a whistleblower or any other activist on the ground. So that can be known to security agencies. Basically, this not only controls your phone, it can even send messages, and that is a big concern for journalists in India following this report by Amnesty International along with the Washington Post.
And Amnesty has named some of the journalists it says have been targeted in this way.
They're naming two journalists. One is Siddharth Varadarajan, editor of The Wire, and then another investigative journalist, Anand Magnale. So both have been critical of the government, and they were doing reports finding out whether the government misused its policies or some of its actions to favor some big businessmen. And now the report clearly states that they found, according to the security experts of Amnesty International, there were traces of this Pegasus spyware. Even though this issue has been going on for the last few years, in October, once again, Apple issued an alert to many people in India, including opposition party activists, saying that it could have been targeted by state-sponsored actors. So that was a big worry for journalists. And there is this report, once again, very categorically says that these two journalists were targeted because they were some of the critics of the government.
It must make it almost impossible to do the important work that journalists do when you're being monitored in this way.
It will make it very impossible. Not only that, not many people can afford to have an iPhone which updates its security procedures. It's very expensive. And the second thing is, what else can you do to protect your sources, to protect your conversations? Because everything now operates, whether it is through WhatsApp chat or any other software, that can be compromised. It becomes complicated. But the government denies using any unauthorized surveillance of these gadgets. But at the same time, it refused to cooperate with a Supreme Court appointed panel to look into the allegations of the spyware being installed in journalist phones.
Anbarasan Etirajan in Delhi. The BBC has been granted exclusive access to a world first, the tallest wind turbine made out of wood, which has already started supplying electricity to the grid in Sweden, where it's based. Almost all turbine towers are made of steel, which burns fossil fuels in the production process. So this new invention is thought to be a lot more environmentally friendly. Our climate correspondent, Jonah Fisher, sent this report.
Following in the footsteps of ABBA, Meatballs and flat-pack furniture, from Sweden comes another innovation.
Welcome to the world's tallest wind turbine tower made out of wood.
Currently, almost all of the world's turbine towers are made of steel, which is usually manufactured by burning fossil fuels.
So these are the transversal joints.
So this is where the big pieces join together.
Exactly.
So the I'm in western Sweden at the invitation of Modvion, the startup behind the wooden tower. As we clamber inside, Chief Executive Otto Lundman tells me it's not just made of wood, but the pieces are joined together
with adhesives.
Glue? So,
yes.
These blades are like almost all wind turbines made out of fiberglass. The generator that I'm standing on is primarily made of steel. But the company who's built the wooden tower say that by making the tower out of wood, it's storing carbon dioxide. It's carbon negative.
But this isn't just about being greener. To reach stronger and more consistent winds, turbines need to get even taller. And that means bigger and wider turbine towers. Getting those massive pieces of steel on site by road is already a major headache. At a factory in Gothenburg, David Olivegren, Modvion's concept engineer, shows me how more than 100 thin sheets of wood are glued together.
These are veneer sheets, and it's from spruce.
Christmas tree.
And spruce is a very common and a very good material.
The smaller pieces can then be more easily transported.
Making a round steel tube is quite easy, but making steel modular towers, that's a challenge, really, because you have lots of bolts. We do not bolt our towers. We glue them together.
So is using wood a serious idea? Well, the project is being backed by Vestas, the world's largest installer of wind power by capacity. Jan Hagen is its chief technology officer for Northern and Central Europe.
Current best knowledge, what we see is that this technology is particularly well suited for wind projects with high hub heights, where we're harvesting stronger winds up there in the in higher hub heights. The market potential for that segment is tremendous in Europe, but also beyond.
Modvion's ambitions are as high as its turbines. It's hoping that in 10 years' time, 10% of all new turbines will be made out of wood.
Jenna Fisher in Sweden. Still to come on this podcast.
It helps me get into this calm state of flow, right? So if you could do 5 hours worth of work in 1 hour, that's huge.
So how productive are you feeling? The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza has reported the deaths of more than 200 Palestinians across the strip in the last 24 hours. Medics said there were casualties in the southern city of Khan Yunis, as well as Maghazi in the central area and Beit Lahia, close to the northern border. Yoland Nell is in Jerusalem.
Israeli warplanes have struck across the length of Gaza, according to local reports. Medics in the southern city of Khan Yunis say that 8 people were killed when a house where displaced families were living was hit. Israeli tanks are also continuing to push into the centre of the Palestinian territory, where tens of thousands of Gazans have been fleeing from the fighting. Today, the Israeli military says it intercepted a drone flown into Israeli airspace from Lebanon. Earlier, an Israeli minister said time was running out for the world and the Lebanese government to act to stop an escalation in attacks by the Lebanese armed group Hezbollah. And there's been a new call from the UN human rights chief urging Israel to stop what he called unlawful killings in the West Bank. The UN says it's verified the deaths of 300 Palestinians by Israeli forces and settlers in the West Bank since early October.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. In case you think we haven't been labouring hard enough over this pod, we're going to take a look now at efforts to make workers more productive. One of the consequences of the COVID pandemic was more people working from home, raising questions about just how productive they were. Well, in the US, there are signs that some workers are resorting to performance-enhancing drugs to improve their output. Our North America business reporter Michelle Fleury has been looking at the story.
In the 60s, psychedelic drugs such as LSD or magic mushrooms were associated with long mind-bending trips, hallucinations, and hippies.
Exploration, transformation.
Today in America, some are taking such Schedule 1 drugs in tiny doses in an attempt to improve focus, productivity and creativity. This is called microdosing.
Essentially, I feel like when I take it, I'm a little bit more open to creative and new ideas, expansive thinking.
Donald, whose name I've changed, microdoses on a regular basis. He says it helps him work.
It helps me get into this calm state of flow, right? So if you could do 5 hours worth of work in 1 hour, that's huge. And not only are you doing that work, but you're more curious, you're more engaged. Like microdosing is essentially a tenth of a, say like a recreational dose. So you're not going to be hallucinating or having a psychedelic experience. So there's a number of different ways that people could regiment it.
What do you do?
So, yeah, I would sometimes take it a few days in a row and then kind of not do it a few days in a row. But I'm usually not so strict about it.
Hallucinogenic drug use has increased among those aged 26 and older, with over 5.5 million people using psychedelics in 2019.
Hey, Shane.
Hey, how's it going?
As attitudes change and more people microdose in the workplace, I caught up with one employer embracing it.
You're taking a stance that, you know, is polarizing at times.
Shane Heath is the founder and CEO of coffee alternative Mudwater.
If somebody chooses microdosing as something that's helpful for them, they're free to do that. We don't have a policy that encourages or supports the use of psychedelics, but we don't have a policy that polices it either, right?
Not only does he support employees who want to microdose at work, Mudwater donates a portion of its profits to psychedelic research and education.
It was just a personal choice to be an advocate.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
It's more than 50 years since then President Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs.
A new all-out offensive.
A policy that hampered research into psychedelics. New studies are being carried out, but there isn't enough evidence yet to say if microdosing is beneficial or even safe. And the drugs being used are illegal at the federal level. Despite the law, that hasn't stopped business leaders from indulging.
Microdosing in the workplace, it sounds like you think it has a role to play.
100%.
Dilip and Siva coaches startup founders.
Most clients, I would say, in this day and age are not concerned around the legal pieces, although they do respect the laws. That's a sea change from, say, 5+ years ago. I think there's a lot of advancement right now around the research, and then we're starting to see the regulation change at different levels, local, state, and national, over time.
There are risks. The unsupervised use of recreational drugs could be psychologically damaging to those with certain mental conditions. But with renewed interest in psychedelics, advocates hope it will help gain mainstream acceptance.
Michelle Fleury. Scientists say they found an easy way to identify water and signs of life on planets in other solar systems. It's based on measuring how much carbon dioxide there is in its atmosphere. Risto Pico has the details.
Our telescopes aren't powerful enough to see exoplanets in detail, but we can study the light they emit, and it carries clear signs of the gases in their atmospheres. We know from Earth that oceans absorb some of the CO2, so measuring a reduced amount of the gas on an exoplanet would strongly imply it has surface water, something that's seen as important for life. Living organisms also absorb carbon dioxide and emit oxygen. This too can be measured when it's transformed into ozone. Together, these two, low CO2 levels and the presence of ozone, would be relatively strong indications of life.
Risto Pico. Now, is this the sound of a world record breaker? The voice of Efua Asantewaa, a Ghanaian media personality and entrepreneur who, as we record this pod, is attempting the Guinness World Record for the longest sing-a-thon. She started singing on Sunday the 24th, and is hoping to beat the record of 105 hours. I spoke to reporter Daniel Dadzi, who is in the crowd in Accra, Ghana.
What's happening right behind me is that Efua Asantewaa is attempting to break the current Guinness World Record for the longest sing-a-thon. The current record is being held by Indian Sunil Wagari, and he did that in 2012, and he sang for 105 hours. Now, officially, that 105-hour mark was crossed at 9 a.m. GMT today. As I speak to you now, that was an hour and 37 minutes ago, because Efua began singing on the 24th of December, and she's been singing for basically about 4 days, and so far 10 hours, 37 minutes. It's a grueling feat. I don't know if any other person would have the capacity to do that.
And Ghana is absolutely fascinated, isn't it?
The whole nation is united behind her. A plethora of media personalities, celebrities, the vice president of the country came here, a number of other notable politicians.
Is it really that difficult, though? I mean, she's just sitting on the stage, she's singing, she's taking quite a lot of breaks. I mean, couldn't we all do it if we had the chance?
I think it sounds easier than it actually is, Alex. I mean, imagine doing anything at all for 8 hours straight is a bit of a chore. Now, think about the fact that you're straining your vocal cords, you're not sleeping as you should, so your energy is drained, and you've been doing this non-stop. The thing is, she's allowed to take a 20-minute break every 4 hours. Or alternatively, she can take a 5-minute break every hour. And those are the only breaks she's allowed to take. However, if she extends any of those breaks, she's going to have to make up for the time. Also, if she does need to take an emergency medical or technical break, she's allowed to do that and it doesn't count against her. Now, Alex, imagine standing and, well, she was sitting at a point, she was lying on the ground at a point. She's only allowed 30 seconds between every song and she has to sing every song for at least 2 minutes. The words have to be intelligible and she can't just go into a jamming or freestyle session. They have to be songs that are known because she would submit that playlist to GWR. It's quite the daunting task.
Daniel Dadsey with that report. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sam Dickinson, and the producer was Terry Egan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.